close all your curtains and climb in an ice bath. It's time for another flat chat. And as Europe bakes in a heatwave, the latest issue of GP Racing magazine is hot off the press. Can you see what I did there? I'm afraid it doesn't get more inspired than that. Too hot to even think. We have a slightly different podcast cast this month. Eagle-eyed readers will have noticed Ben Anderson taking his leave in last month's editorial. Ben's gone off to pastures new. This thing, it's called the internet. I'm sure it'll never catch on. Thanks to Ben for his magnificent leadership over the past 3 years, his contributions to this podcast, a podcast which was his idea. And unfortunately, we didn't get to say goodbye to him in a podcast because, like a lot of people who have to serve just 1 month notice period, he bogged off on holiday for a week of it. So, and then I bogged off to Silverstone. So there was no cast to pod. So we are going to have, joining us in Ben's stead on this podcast, live from Gateshead, stepping into his shoes, if not the space left by his teeth, it's Autosport's Matt Kew.
Thank you for having me, Collis. What an introduction. I can say, Ben, I have nice pearly whites, but nothing of the same scale as Ben Anderson's. But I like to think at 6'5", I'm probably edging him in the stepping into his shoes. I feel like I can fill into that. And yeah, broadcasting from a sunny Gateshead, proving that this far north, you still do get the warmer temperatures.
Hawaii, it is allegedly not so grim up north at the moment. And let's move to sunnier climes down south. Busy packing his suitcase to go on holiday, and listeners will know that there is an excellent instructional video on how to pack a suitcase on YouTube. Welcome back, Mark Gallagher.
Very nice to be here. You've just reminded me I better go and pack after this. I will go and watch your very detailed explanation video. That's a few years old now, isn't it?
It is. I mean, things have changed. There's no point in taking a network cable because no self-respecting press room has a network these days. You have to rely on Wi-Fi. I view that as a retrograde step.
Also, I have to say, Matt, nice to have a chat with you today. This reconnects me with Autosport 39 years after I went to work for the magazine. And I was looking up this morning. Next year will be my 40th anniversary. That's a ruby wedding anniversary, apparently. So any rubies are very welcome if you want to send them to Chipping Norton.
I want to say that is a fantastically impressive achievement, but unfortunately, Mark, I was on Facebook earlier and saw Marcus Pye, and this week is his 45th anniversary appearing in Autosport. So it's
45
a second place.
Years of Pye.
Yes, absolutely. Wonderful stuff. Wonderful stuff. But congratulations. That's excellent work. And I don't know. I aspire to sustain a career, certainly sustain a career in motorsport journalism, hopefully working for Autosport for that long if I can keep up a convincing enough case for them to retain me.
I'm not sure if this is anything for me to be celebrating. It's just literally a question of survival. It's not really achievement. It's just surviving. So well done to Marcus Pye, who I have very fond memories of. Haven't seen him for an age, but I know he's still waxing lyrical and still an expert on all kinds of things that most people will never know anything about.
Formula 5000, Chevrons, mighty 6-litre Chevrolet V8.
Well, it was Marcus who impressed upon me the need to get chassis and engine numbers when I was covering racing for Autosport back in the day, and I used to go and plague people for such detail. I noticed that has now seems to have dropped away off the list of things that journalists gather during race weekends, although I'm not sure if that's totally widespread. Cotters, do you get chassis numbers and engine numbers?
Chassis numbers are a bit of a sore point because, judging by one of the snotty reviews of my collected book of Ferrari Formula One World Championship race cars, some people do view chassis numbers as very important. One of the complaints, indeed, it was that there are no chassis numbers in this book. And to that person, I'm going to have to go a little bit Partridge and say good luck trying to trace Ferrari chassis numbers, given that such things were regularly chiselled off and moved to other cars to get cars across borders back in the day. before we had a thing called the European Union, which enabled things to move a little bit more freely across borders. Anyway, a little bit of politics. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Ben Elton. Shall we talk about this month's GP Racing magazine? On the cover, we feature George Russell and ask if he's got what it takes to become the next British F1 world champion. And regular readers will know we have a rich history in this regard. In 2001, yes, 2001, we described Kimi Raikkonen on the cover as Ferrari's next world champion. And it might have taken another 6 years for that to actually happen, but we got it right in the end, and we were able to do the I was right dance. We're nothing if not patient on this magazine. So, George Russell, Britain's next world champion. Does anyone here have a dissenting view? I'm going to come to Mark first because you're starting to gurn a little bit.
I don't really have a dissenting view with that. I hope that you have forecast more world champions than just Kimi over the last two and a bit decades.
I think we might have done, but that's one that's
sprung
to mind.
Well, that's one that sprung to mind. Okay, good. I mean, George, what an impressive guy he is, and, you know, both on and off the track. And I think that, you know, when you glance at his record, you know, championship titles in, you know, Formula 4 and GP3 and Formula 2, I mean, the rise, the trajectory couldn't really have been that much better. And he then has really had to earn his apprenticeship in Formula 1. With those 3 years at Williams, which he now admits were, you know, probably quite tiring, but wearying after a while. I think there's, you know, the first year there's a novelty of being in Formula One and learning all the ropes. At year two, you want to start to see a bit of progress. By the end of year three, he must have been pretty disenchanted with turning up and being at the back most of the time. So, you know, he's admitted that. So he is of the moment, you know, his timing is now right, and we see that with how he's performing in Mercedes, albeit in a Mercedes that has had a few issues, as we've discussed in the past. But, you know, Mercedes will come back, and as they come back and George continues his rise, we will get to the point of the tail end of Lewis Hamilton's career. And when will that come? Well, you know, we know he signed a new contract, but the reality is that the in terms of George, as you know, becoming a number one driver at Mercedes, that's not too far away. Are we going to have some interesting tussles between George and Russell, George and Lewis? I think it'll be a really interesting challenge for the team. Probably next year. You know, I think this year everyone's in the trenches fighting the good fight to sort out the car. I think if they have a competitive car next season, I expect to see from the get-go a much more robust inter-team rivalry, and it'll be a question of how both the drivers and the leadership team manage that. But I think they've all learned a great deal since the darker days of the Rosberg-Hamilton inter-team duel. I think certainly the leadership of the team have learned a lot. George is a very intelligent guy. He will have. Obviously, he knows the team well. He will have watched what Valtteri did, not from a perspective of ending up, you know, playing second fiddle to Lewis, but just in respect of the harmony and the benefit of having harmony in the team. So whilst he's got a very steely, competitive interior, I think he also has the intellectual ability to understand that time is on his side and those world championships will eventually come. And I suspect for George they can't come soon enough, but you know, the years have a habit of moving along at pace, as I'm sure Max Verstappen would now admit, considering he's now regarded as something as a almost a veteran, and he's only just reaching his mid-20s. So George has got everything to look forward to. He's done a terrific job this season, and I have no doubt that he's going to be one of the primary stars of Formula One over the course of the next decade. So no dissenting voice really on my side. I will just finish by saying we're very fortunate in our sport to have so many drivers who become good ambassadors for the sport in the way they conduct themselves, the way they come across, the way they, well, frankly, the way they behave. And George is just another one in a long list of drivers. And I think at a, that are of that kind. And I think at a time when, you know, every utterance of every driver is poured over on social media and by the mainstream media as well, you know, George has a very bright future because he's got his head well screwed on. He's obviously got good people around him, and he's going to be a great ambassador for Formula One and for the sport.
He does allude to being a little bit impatient, actually. I've never sort of witnessed that myself, but I was watching an episode of Drive to Survive the other day, and it's the one where it's him up against Valtteri Bottas, and he's sort of lunching with his girlfriend somewhere, and he alludes to being impatient. He says, "I want everything now." I kind of thought, well, that's dropping a neat Arcade Fire reference there. Matt Q, one of his weekly duties, or occasionally weekly duties, when he's alternating with Alex Kalinauskas on the Autosport race reportage beat, is to compose the driver ratings, the controversial but always very accurate, in my opinion, driver ratings. So, and that entails being up all night, basically, not to get lucky, but to watch through various onboards and review races. So, Matt, you've been able to, I think, follow a little bit in the slipstream of our fellow contributor Luke Smith, who wrote this feature, and kind of debunk some of the myths that have grown up this season about the mainstream press. Certainly seems to have gone all in on George already having the better of Lewis. That's not quite fair to say yet, is it?
No, absolutely not. And I would say, after sharing accommodation with you in Austria, I hope I wouldn't be up all night to get lucky, but never mind. Move it. Focusing more on Russell, I think the narrative sort of started to change around the Canadian Grand Prix, in the sense that we've had a run of races where Russell was out-qualifying Hamilton. And obviously Hamilton is a record pole sitter in Formula 1, but certainly against Valtteri Bottas is probably where Bottas was closer over in the one lap stake. So the fact that Russell was then ahead is more sort of reflective of probably Hamilton's position and how he's maximised previous Mercedes, rather than him being necessarily a one lap sensation, like perhaps many suppose. But then he had the good run of races, and we, you know, this Mr. Consistency name that came out from the top five running results. But come the Canadian Grand Prix, Hamilton then sort of went a bit more public, and I suppose that's when the noise was most rife, that, oh, has Hamilton lost it? Is he demotivated? I think it was Sir Jackie Stewart floating the idea that perhaps he should have retired at the end of 2021. And then we had this narrative that actually Hamilton, as this veteran, as the experienced guy, he was taking on the radical setups to try and really eliminate this bouncing. And don't forget as well, we've got two types of bouncing with the W13. One where it's porpoising, which is the airflow attaching and installing and going up and down. And then the other one is that to counterbalance that, you have to weld the car in place by running everything as stiff as you can. And that makes it super sensitive to the imperfections in the asphalt. So they've got two types of bouncing. And so basically they were starting Hamilton with really radical experiments, and sort of, I suppose, allowing Russell to sort of dip his toe in the water, sort of be a bit more sensitive to it, and then finding the happy ground in the middle. And Hamilton was more often than not coming off worse than that. And now since then, it's been much closer. Obviously Hamilton had the podium in Silverstone, and if you look at Barcelona, Silverstone, and also last time out in Austria, every time we talked about Mercedes turning a corner, it's been based on Hamilton's race pace rather than Russell's. So I do believe he has had the edge in terms of performances, if not in terms of results. And then you look at how they fared in Austria, which is, as the time of recording, the most recent Grand Prix, crashes in near identical circumstances, sort of snap oversteer, losing the rear, both which Toto Wolff alluded to as being driver error, them going too fast in a car that's fundamentally tricky to drive. And the fact that both sort of finding the limits of this car suggests that they are really, really equal.
It's also the case, isn't it, that Lewis had some pretty bad luck at various races earlier this year, didn't he? Like starting on the wet line in Imola, some bad safety car timings, and all of that has played into this sort of slightly daft mainstream media narrative that he's yesterday's man. I'm actually quite disappointed that Sir Jackie Stewart should sort of pop out and diss Lewis from his the the penthouse suite in his ivory tower, because obviously Jackie retired nice and early and had a good commercial screw on afterwards. But was it 99 races Jackie did? Yeah, not actually that many. Even rookie Lance Stroll has just exceeded that number, and he's still a rookie according to Aston Martin. So, not a great deal of Grand Prix in the bank, and an awful lot of success. And certainly his wallet has been particularly successful over the past 30 or 40 years. Just doesn't strike me as a very wise thing to say to slag off Britain's most successful racing driver ever, but. There you go. Some people do like to carp from the sidelines, don't they?
I mean, I know Jackie. I don't know Jackie well, but I've had lots of conversations with him over the years. I've known his sons along the way too. They're a good family. They have a very broad-minded view of the world. They've had lots of their own trials and tribulations to overcome along the way. So it's not been an easy path for the Stewart family at all times. Any Lewis Hamilton fans listening to this will be thinking I'm about to mount a sturdy defence of what Jackie said, or is reported to have said. And all I know is a number of years ago, there was a particular headline attributed to Jackie. And when I actually read the entire quote, it was one of those scenarios where the headline had been spun, no question about it. He referred to Lewis's, you know, fashion sense, and it made me realise that there's a really fundamental problem here, which is that, you know, when you take a Jackie Stewart who's now in his 80s and a journalist calls them up and they interview him and ask for an opinion about, you know, Lewis's fashion sense, I mean, why are they even asking Jackie about that? And when it comes to retirement, I mean, is Jackie wrong to say that if Lewis were to be burdened with an uncompetitive car, a 2 or 3 year end to his career in an uncompetitive car would somehow kind of damage his legacy? I mean, I don't think it's the wrong sentiment. If there's, you know, Lewis himself wouldn't want to spend the last 3 years of his career in an uncompetitive car, and that's actually a point worth discussing. That's not a criticism of Lewis. It's certainly not saying he should disappear. So I wonder about the context within this. And, you know, I'm beginning to think that, you know, any journalist worth their salt who now picks up the phone or goes and sees someone aged over, you know, 75 from Formula One's distant past, I mean, really, what are you looking for? Because if the purpose is to get an elder statesman of the sport to say something that's inappropriate for the times we live in, well, you're probably going to get it if you ask enough of the right questions or enough of the wrong questions, depending what way you look at it. So whether it's a Mario Andretti, a Jackie Stewart, or dare I even mention his name, Bernie Eccleston, you know, after his recent outpourings, you know, I mean, I don't know why anyone would phone or set up an interview with Bernie Eccleston. He's a 91-year-old who's no longer involved in the sport at all. He arguably stayed around too long anyway, you know, at least a decade longer than really he should have stayed as leader of the sport. And I say that in the context that we all recognise the extraordinary achievements that he had during most of his professional career in building Formula One into the sport it is. So, you know, the Jackie Stewart thing kind of, I just feel, again, I'd love to see the full, I'd love to listen to the tape. I'd love to listen to the full quote and find out what the context around that was. Because if all that is taken away from it is Jackie Stewart says Lewis Hamilton should retire, really, you know. So it certainly Lewis shouldn't retire. Lewis should continue for as long as he wants to race in Formula One, and we should all absolutely relish, you know, the fact that, after, my goodness, a decade and a half, he is still at the forefront of this game and still such a significant player. But so, you know, that you know, the thing about the Hamilton Russell partnership, I find it really fascinating. You know, when you have a driver who is getting towards the end of his career, and even if we said Lewis had, let's say he decided to stay around for another 4 or 5 years, he's still getting towards the end of his career. So you've got a driver, absolutely the supreme talent of Formula One, getting towards the end of his career, and you have this guy who's come in the last 4 years and is just such a nicely rounded, so competitive teammate for Lewis to have. And that interaction, that balance between the two of them is so interesting. And going back to the points that you were making, Matt, you know, that I found it really so mature of the team to say to George, right, you're new to the team, you've got to learn the car, you've got to learn the way we operate as a team, you just got to bed yourself in, we're going to give you a stable platform, even if it's a slightly porpoising stable platform, we'll give you a stable platform. And Lewis, we're going to throw some throw some challenges at you, because you know you've been around the block with us, you know the ins and outs of how we do things, the configuration of the cars, the way we like to run them, the way you like to drive them, the way that we want to engineer the car to get the performance that we're looking for. So I think the way the team, including their use of the drivers, operated over the first half of this season is really, really interesting. Shows a huge amount of maturity. They're not thrashing around, throwing everything at both drivers. They're trying to come up with a program which gives them a stable transition towards having the car that they now have, which is, you know, much better than it was, still not, you know, able to race wheel to wheel, as it were, with Red Bull and Ferrari in terms of outright pace, but you know, it's getting there, and it's a heck of a lot better than it was. So again, that bodes well for the future, getting their drivers to work together and for the team to have a plan, and then together they all work in the strategy to deliver the outcomes that they're looking for. And I think George's impatience, you know, that's natural. I mean, if a Formula One driver is not impatient to win, you know, there'll have to be something wrong with him. So I think that's good. And it's really a question of just how he channels that. As long as the impatience doesn't become frustration, you know, he clearly has the ability to do what needs to be done, and it'll come to him for sure.
I do wonder with the Hamilton-Russell relationship, that narrative has changed considerably. If you remember back to last year, before the deal was announced for Russell to join and before he did the Sakhir Grand Prix, Hamilton was sort of talking up the merits of Bottas, and I suppose it's someone he knew that he could work well with, but ultimately had licked. And whereas Russell would come in, young pretender, who was obviously, you know, knew would be desperate for wins. But now he's really softened on that. And I do wonder if any of it is sort of legacy building. So as Mark says, you know, you can go at the top, or you know, could it be considered a decline if the car wasn't quite at the same level, and so he's getting fifth and sixth rather than wins? But is it anything to do with sort of like that Sir Alex Ferguson mentality, where he left in, you have a string of underwhelming managers, and some people look at it, go, wow, look at his achievements in that final year with actually what turned out to be a pretty pants set of circumstances? Or is other people going, well, he left and left us in a really bad shape with a terrible squad? And I do wonder if there's an element of that. Obviously, it's not quite a direct translation between football and Formula One, but part of Hamilton's legacy, because he is, in the main, certainly in a motorsport context, he is the face of Mercedes. He has to hand that baton on, and basically by rounding Russell, by ingratiating him to, you know, how he works in engineering debriefs, and we know Russell's been a part of that for such a long time, by talking him up in the media, by having this sort of not matey but certainly like a cordial relationship, whether that's a very symbolic handing on a torch, making life almost as easy as it can be for Russell to come in and then extend the success. Because also, let's take a step back in the driver market. You've got Verstappen, long-term contract at Red Bull, Leclerc, long-term contract at Ferrari, same with Norris at McLaren if they're really ever in that hunt right at the front. So Russell's position really is at Mercedes for certainly the foreseeable. It's hard to see where that is disrupted. So, you know, Hamilton isn't a stakeholder directly, but surely it's in his best interest to sort of, you know, keep everything marching forward, keep it as competitive as it can be by helping Russell get there.
He's also been playing a greater commercial role in the team, like helping with sponsor procurement and things like that, hasn't he, Lewis? So, you know, you can imagine a scenario where he's not one of those drivers who will just leave Formula One when he retires, never to be seen again, and except in, you know, glossy magazine shoots in their Brazilian ranch or whatever. I suspect that he's going to pay a little bit back. He's obviously earned a lot of money out of Formula One, but I think he's going to pay a lot back in, certainly with his, you know, his charitable work and the effort he's putting in to promote education and diversity in the grid, but also, you know, further down the ranks in motorsport. You know, not for nothing has he been made a knight of the realm.
You're both absolutely right what you say about setting up this legacy. I think the legacy, so first of all, his sporting legacy is never going to be dented. You know, his achievements are undoubted. The one shadow, and it's not of his making, is the fact that he doesn't have 8 Drivers' World Championships to his credit, and he should have. And, I mean, at the weekend, I was at a couple of events, and before recording this podcast, so at a couple of events, nothing to do with Formula One, just talking to people who happen to follow the sport. Everyone's saying the same thing to me, you know, about, you know, love Formula One, love what's happened to it, my goodness, you know, what happened last year was wrong. And so, you know, I think everyone realises Lewis had such a profound impact on our sport and continues to do so. And you're both right. You know, he's going to carve a legacy, and I'm sure working with Toto will want to help to shape that so that he stays permanently involved. You know, we're going to talk a little bit later on the podcast about David Coulthard. You know, David retired from Formula One as a race driver in 2008. Here we are 14 years later, and he is still an ambassador for Red Bull and highly involved with Red Bull in lots of different ways. You can imagine the same thing being the case for Lewis Hamilton and Mercedes-Benz. I'm sure when he's 50, 55, Mercedes-Benz will still be using or wanting to use Lewis Hamilton for events. So that legacy will be there. Only today he's tweeted about the importance of paying it forward, talking about young Carters, 3 young Carters that he brought to Silverstone, who he's supporting to, again, bring up through the ranks in terms of ensuring that the diversity and inclusion continues. Whenever I did that event with him, that I've spoken to you about before, Carters, before COVID, it was an event in Singapore, he talked to me about the fact that, you know, his biggest fear is that it'll be another 20 years before there's another black driver in Formula One. He wants to do everything he can to make sure that there is actually a pipeline of talent coming through that represents society around the world that the World Championship reaches out to. So in that regard, then you can take it a step further and say, when Lewis does leave in Formula One, would he like to leave with Mercedes-Benz as a competitive team, with George Russell being the one who picks up the baton and wins, you know, multiple world championships? I think the answer is almost certainly of course, because he'll want to do that. And I love the Alex Ferguson point. I always remember an interview with someone, on BBC Radio 4, a sports journalist, and him saying you definitely wouldn't want to be Alex Ferguson's replacement. You'd want to be the person who replaces the person who replaces Alex Ferguson, because whoever comes in afterwards has this unenviable task. And it's a little bit like that, isn't it, with Lewis and Mercedes. But in George, they've got the man who really ought to be able to do that. And I think, and listen, I don't think for one second Lewis will ever want to be beaten to a title at Mercedes-Benz by George Russell, so long as he's racing there. I think we'll draw the line there and say he's not about to hand the baton over in such a ready fashion. But if circumstances developed outside of Lewis's control, I've no doubt that, you know, he would do whatever he could to support George. And I certainly agree with your point, Matt, that, you know, come the end of his career, I think Lewis will want to, well, he won't be leaving Mercedes, he'll simply be segueing from being a Formula One race driver into, goodness knows, they'll come up with a very suitable role that he will want to perform in the team going forward. And I think that'll all be quite seamless. And I expect the strength of that team to continue. And one final point I should say is that, you know, if as we expect, there are a couple of major German car manufacturers arriving in the sport in 2026, the pressure is actually on the likes of Mercedes-Benz to weather that storm when it breaks upon their shore, because, you know, Porsche and Audi aren't going to come in to finish second. They tend not to do things by half. There'll be a huge effort going from the Volkswagen Audi group, you know, when that hopefully is all put, you know, finished off. And for Mercedes to meet that, that's another kettle of fish on top of, you know, trying to beat Christian Horner's Red Bull team and Mattia Binotto's Ferrari.
I do sometimes think that it'll be 2026 before the 2026 engine regulations are actually decided and signed off.
Thank goodness, we'll check
the VW Audi thing coming in. But if we'll let's move on now from a potential. I'll enunciate that word in the Murray Walker style, potential British world champion to one celebrating the 30th anniversary of lifting the trophy. And just saying that sentence made me feel quite old. Yeah, it's 30 years since Nigel Mansell won the Formula One World Championship, and he drove his 1992 championship winner for the first time in almost 30 years at Goodwood recently. Our man Morris Hamilton was there, has composed a lovely a fly on the wall view of the whole day, lovely atmospheric take. He spoke to Nigel about lots of things, including what Nigel thought about the present generation of Formula One drivers. And it was very pleasing to learn that Nigel didn't have some crapulent hot take that it's not as good as it was in my day. He's very, very favourable about the current crop, which is very pleasing to see. Very, very interesting for me to see that Nigel's only just been reunited with the car. I mean, he did have one, has put it up for auction a while ago, I think. Sebastian Vettel bought it. I think the one that he drove at Goodwood might be the one out of the Nigel Mansell Museum. He's also liquidated his Ferrari recently, which is a little bit bizarre. And also the difficulties involved in actually firing up an old Renault V10, because even Renault don't know how to do that anymore. So lots and lots to get into there.
So it is chassis 11 that Nigel Mansell was driving at Goodwood, as opposed to chassis number 8 that Vettel has bought, which also includes the Renault V10 number 240, I might add. But it's always a topic that interests me, sort of rebuilding old cars. And I've done some various pieces on it before, like Emerson Fittipaldi when he was reunited with his Lotus 72D that I ended up as, I think was it his Zandvoort, ended up as sort of a crumpled beer can, and how they rebuilt that. But the 90s is obviously the active era, and so the difficulty there is obviously, more than anything, it's the electronics. So if you think, I'm trying to think of what's the comparison I can relate to. If I was trying to plumb in my old PlayStation 2. I don't know, Codders, it might be a Sega Mega Drive for you, but a PlayStation 2 for me.
Zerg 81.
Absolutely, but everything you need now is an HDMI cable, whereas back then it was SCART, and so you need, male, female cables. You need to all to talk to one another. So I know that when it was a Williams 40th anniversary celebration at Silverstone, 14B, the reason it hadn't been seen out in so long before, I think it was Karun Chandhok might have been the first person to drive it, and then Nigel then, was getting the electronics to work, because you need a 90s laptop to talk to a 90s car. And while you might want to keep a 90s car preserved, no one really wants to keep a 90s laptop working. So it's been about, and it's also like, an aftermarket immobiliser or something on your car that you would have fitted in the 80s or whatever. That it's not a case of just sort of wiring in and wiring off. Once you try and disrupt that, it can shut the whole thing down. So that was what they were trying to sort of prize apart. That's the word I'm looking for. To
reverse engineer, perhaps, might be some sort of descriptor.
Absolutely, reverse engineer and trying to get everything taught to each other, and then basically fine, once you've done that, then get like a control electronics that is a modern, more sort of adaptable substitute, and that happens with all sort of the cars at anniversaries, and you're seeing again with some of the runs with Corsa Clienti, Ferrari's program, and how they keep the 90s car and the early semi-automatic BA boxes going. So that's just sort of one thing. I think that's just sort of one of the key areas, but that car is so special. I wasn't at Goodwood for the first time in a long time this year, sadly, but I have seen that 14B before, and it was actually at Silverstone. It was very, very quiet event, and it was just in the corner, just again plugged into a really thick sort of like 3-inch laptop that was obviously from the period. It just sits there in the corner in a dark garage, just sort of doing its compressions and elevations as a suspension calibrates. And I'm not too poetic, sort of, I don't get too sycophantic, but I thought if ever there was a car that's alive, it's definitely an active car just doing its thing in a corner, and you sort of watch it pitch and wallow and fantastic. And as we saw at Silverstone, and all with the interviews that Nigel Mansell did at Goodwood and for Channel 4, he really plays up to the fans. He knows how to keep modern. I think we were watching Vettel's 14B run from Silverstone, and you notice he gets out in the car, and then there's a very thick Brummy grip on his wrist as Nigel leads into the crowd and sort of gets a huge cheer from the crowd. But I think again, that's, you know, it's a Drive to Survive generation. That's a way of Mansell sort of keeping relevant, ingratiating to fans, and then having have this all-round appreciation of history. So, I thought he played up really well. And having read the piece, Maurice Hamilton beautifully describes it, how sort of Mansell was very much working to his own schedule that weekend. It's a really, really nice story, accompanied by some beautiful pictures of a fantastic summer's day at Goodwood.
That's fantastic. I love seeing this kind of dream come true run come back to life, you know, because when people have the idea, oh, we will just get this driver to just drive that car, it triggers a whole bunch of things. And you talked about the 14B. When Karen Chandhok drove that car, he posted on Twitter a photograph of the only memory card in existence which has got the coding to run the active suspension, and it's 1 megabyte. So for anyone listening, you know, well, that's tiny, you know, 1 megabyte. I mean, you know, I don't know, it's hard to describe how small 1 megabyte is, other than the fact that, you know, just about anything you do these days involves several gig just to watch a movie. So, you know, it's 1 megabyte of data, and they've had to maintain an old PC tower with the relevant slots to keep that card going. Goodness knows what's going to happen when it falls apart. Intrigued to see that my former colleagues at Cosworth, particularly Cosworth Electronics, stepped in to help with the running of that Renault V10. So again, when I was at Cosworth, one of the things that used to happen periodically is people would call us up to say, I've bought a historic car, it's got this engine, you know, the ECU's missing, or it's broken, or, you know, we can't get it to run, can you come and help us out? Going back to talking about Sir Jackie Stewart has several of his Stewart Grand Prix cars running, obviously, Ford Cosworth engines. And again, Cosworth were actually restoring the engines for him as recently as 2012, and making sure that all of the software was intact, so that if and when he or the family ever wants to run them in the future, or sell them in the future, they'll be able to be operated as they were originally intended. Nigel, I mean, he's just a legend, and, you know, it's an overused term, legend, in motorsport generally. In Nigel's case, I think it's well deserved. He was a guy who came from truly humble, you know, background. He came up the hard way. He impressed people along the way. He got the breaks as a result, and then ultimately, you know, secured that world championship title. I was working as a full-time freelance journalist in the 1980s in Formula One, and also for my, you know, to earn a bit of proper money, I was actually also writing the PR for Canon, who sponsored Williams. And I also used to moderate and host the events that Nigel and his teammates would participate in. And that just watching him at Silverstone and Goodwood just brought back so many memories of those days and that time, and what, you know, the superstar that he was. And I mean, when I say superstar, including some of the difficulties of working with Nigel, because he had a good sense of his own value. You know, he wasn't averse to being a little bit of a prima donna at times, but, you know, that was all part of the makeup. And I think we forget just, you know, the Mansell, Prost, Senna. I mean, those guys were just on another level. You know, they attracted a vast amount of media attention. And of course, you know, going back to a column I wrote recently about how few international media are travelling to Formula One races in the wake of the COVID pandemic. You know, if you go back to the late 1980s, early 1990s, every national newspaper in the UK would send a journalist. Quite often a staff member would actually go to you know, all the Formula One races. And so the British press corps on its own was several dozen strong every single race, lots of print media, and then the German media and the Japanese media and the French media. I mean, it was extraordinary. It was a really, really big contingent, and Nigel was always, you know, at the centre of that, or trying to beat them off, because they were always trying to dream up stories. And my editors at the Sunday Express was one of the newspapers I worked for. My editor used to call me each week and say, I don't want to know about anyone other than Nigel Mansell. I want you to find out what he's been doing. If he's been late for a dinner, I want you to write a story about it. If he's been, you know, caught speeding, if he's, you know, whatever he's doing, he's playing golf with someone interested, I just want a Nigel Mansell story. So I used to go off and you know, merrily file major interviews with Alain Prost or Riccardo Patrese, and they would just be rejected. You know, the editor would phone me and say, I'm not interested in Riccardo Patrese, I just want Nigel Mansell headline, and you know, he's all that's important to me. And that, you know, the Mansell mania was not just amongst the general public, it was amongst the media. They were absolutely obsessed with Nigel and everything that he did. You know, was he fit enough? You know, that was a kind of a narrative that always ran. Was he fit enough? You know, because Senna was, you know, always bit, you know, being photographed out jogging. You know, Nigel would be photographed, you know, having a quiet game of golf or whatever. So there was kind of all these narratives around Nigel as well. And but I had, you know, so many enjoyable moments in Nigel's presence as a result, because he was such a major star at the time. And, you know, when you were hosting him on stage, you know, you'd get him on stage, and my goodness, he was fantastic with audiences. He loved answering questions. You know, he would talk about, you know, answer any question in a really sort of open, honest, you know, Mansell-type way, you know, about what he thought about Senna. You know, he's got the beating of Senna. Yeah, I'll beat Senna on Sunday, you know, and the crowd would roar with appreciation and all of that good stuff. But I'll share one just kind of bizarre thing that happened. I mean, I've got 101 Nigel Mansell stories to tell, but, you know, as anyone who's ever been involved in PR will know that one of the most dangerous things is when you produce PR materials for a team and a sponsor, and it then gets sent off to be translated into foreign languages. And for the Portuguese Grand Prix, I had to write an article about Nigel Mansell's hopes for the weekend ahead in Estoril. And it went off to Canon Europe sent it off to their translation house, and it came back to Canon Europe, and they, you know, back in those days, they photocopied, you know, like 600 of these previews, and they were all put in the press centre for the Portuguese Grand Prix. And I turned up in the paddock and went to see Nigel and the team at the beginning of the weekend. And I got up into the press centre, and the guy from Canon is there, and he's apoplectic. And I said, well, what's wrong? And he said, it's about this preview you've written. It's completely wrong. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, he said, you know, if you read it, you know, you'll see. So I'd written that Nigel was hoping for a better weekend, having previously stalled on the grid. And it had been translated as Nigel Mansell's hoping to have a better weekend as at the previous race, he set up a merchandise stall on the grid. and this had been translated into a number of other languages and then stuck in the press centre, and it caused much amusement at the thought of Nigel turning up. Ayrton sitting there in his McLaren Honda. Meanwhile, Nigel's got selling a few caps and T-shirts on the second slot on the grid.
Reminds me of when Steve Safer said, oh, I'm sorry, I went off on a tandem.
Lovely. But anyway, my final comment on Nigel, just such a hero, and no one better than Morris to go and observe.
One of the things we discussed behind the scenes, the editorial team, was the possibility of maybe having Nigel on the cover for this issue. And let's just say that my colleagues roundly shot that down on the grounds that, you know, old blokes don't sell magazines, etc., and, you know, young people won't know or care who he is, etc., and all he's done is drive his old car. I kind of thought, well, I suppose that's fair enough. We'll go back to plan A. We'll revert back, as a former colleague of ours once said. So in this, to bring this incredibly long-winded question to some sort of conclusion, Matt, what does Nigel Mansell mean to you?
In that meeting, I'd have raised an objection because a little personal anecdote. I don't think it was the first GP Racing, F1 Racing, as it then was, magazine that I ever bought, but certainly the one that made me commit to being a subscriber was 2011 had Mansell on the front with a sort of a ready shirt, I think, with blue stripes on, sort of just giving his memories and then again his views on contemporary F1 as it then was. I can't say there's a specific point where he came onto my radar, I suppose, just as a fan of the sport in general and Formula One specifically, sort of through osmosis, you learn about him. I did actually tune in or at least found a hooky stream for the original GP Masters race in Kyle Army, which he won ahead of Emerson Fittipaldi. Yes. So I have seen him, unfortunately never in his pomp and in various bits. But in terms of how I rate him, in my previous role, I had to edit a little section at the back of Autosport magazine, and every now and again tried to do something fun. And one of the sort of ideas was a bucket list, a motorsport bucket list, and it was any car, any driver, any racetrack, and you would basically plonk yourself on the grassy bank, and who would you want to watch? And various people, but the three that we try and break it up so there's not repeat offenders, so someone gets Senna, someone gets whoever and whoever, and the two that kept coming up were Nigel Mansell and Stefan Bellof as who you would expect to get in any given car, whether it's a 956, a McLaren F1 GTR, if I look at the models I've got on my windowsill, a Ford GT, whatever, and who would you expect within three laps to absolutely ruin its neck, and that was as Mansell. And then it's after that I heard stories. I think there's a good story, I won't retell it now, it's not mine, but of a famous car magazine interview that Nigel Mansell did at Silverstone that did, or maybe your optimal word should be didn't happen, and sort of the aura that comes with him, obviously, you know, the Il Leone, getting the F40 at Ferrari, the and then you see the videos of him running on track at Silverstone. So I think there is certainly enough source material, as it were, to come and appreciate him. I do feel slightly aggrieved I never got to see him in his pomp, but I suppose, you know, I live in the most modern minute, so I can appreciate Hamilton of his time now, and then further my reading and watch videos to sort of try and get an appreciation of how enduringly successful and popular Mansell was, to the point where also another early memory is him fronting the Money Supermarket ads or whatever it was, that he was still that popular 10 years later, that he could be tooling around in a Nissan Micra, and that was the way of selling car insurance.
I remember that car magazine interview as a reader of the magazine at the time, and I do actually possess it, because when the late Russell Bulgin died, his ex-colleagues put together an anthology of some of his greatest journalistic hits, and remarkably this interview was part of it, because for want of a better word, I'm sure you can find it on the internet, it does not go well. And Russell, I don't know whether he's actually set out to antagonise him, but he rubs R. Nige up the wrong way, and it wends to a conclusion when Nigel basically tells him to F off, and that this is included in the interview. It's what would have been described as car crash TV if it was indeed on TV. A fascinating interview, and a great writer, one of my favourite car journalists of the 80s and the mid-90s, Russell Bulgin. But perhaps he and Nigel Mansell not destined to rub along as bezzy mates.
Nigel had a sometimes difficult relationship with particularly the UK media. Again, it's an interesting thing, isn't it? It's your domestic media. And I think that was because of the intensity with which they were constantly reporting on him. Also the fact that because of his intensely competitive nature, it really irritated him that, you know, he wasn't winning the world championships, and that Prost and Senna were being constantly positioned, including by the British media, as, you know, on a different level. And you know, we all have our own unique, you know, ways of doing things. Nigel was the same, and he could not be easy. And as a result, people didn't sometimes build a close relationship. And of course, it takes two to tango in that. So you've got media not building quite the close enough relationship with him, or him not building quite the close enough relationship with them. And so as a result, interviews could go the wrong way. You mentioned Russell Bulgin. I mean, there were a number of other journalists I can think of who had really quite confrontational relationships with Nigel during the course of their career. One in particular, Mark Fogarty from Australia, who, you know, ended up, basically the FIA insisted that Nigel apologise to him because of an outburst during a press conference. So, you know, there was that. And as I say, you know, both parties probably could have tackled things in a slightly different way. But it's interesting, you know, to see Nigel come back all these years later, and I just love the euphoria that we saw around that, and his smiling face, and you know, to see him at the British Grand Prix, you know, watching Vettel, you know, driving around in the Williams, and the way he was greeted, the way Nigel was greeting him and greeting Lewis, and as you say, Cottage, you know, the way Nigel talks about the current generation of drivers, you know, he's obviously older. Is he wiser? I think he's perhaps, you know, with the passage of time, really come to position how he is viewed in the world in the right way. I mean, he is one of the greats, and as a world champion, you know, he achieved something special. And let no one say, well, it's all down to the car or something like that. I mean, the fact of the matter is, he was always fantastic behind the wheel of everything, and you know, cream rises to the top. He ended up getting himself in the right car at the right time, and that's what all the great champions manage to do.
I'm not surprised he was a bit narky with the British press if he couldn't even take Roseanne out for a cheeky lunch somewhere without you popping out from behind a pot plant with your daily with your Sunday Express hat on.
Sunday Express paparazzi, exactly.
Yeah. What are you having for starters, Nigel?
Leave me alone.
Onto a more convivial interview. We have brought back the long-form interview format this month, and you are the man in the hot seat, Mark. You spoke to David Coulthard, a 13-time Grand Prix winner, very successful businessman, and as well as sort of co-founding Whisper TV, which has really grown, award-winning company. He's put a lot of energy into creating opportunities for women in motorsport. And one of the things that emerged from this interview I didn't know was that a lot of that motivation has come from the memory of his sister who died, 2013? And he said she was faster than me in karting but didn't get the opportunity she deserved.
As you know, I know David well, and you know we work together from time to time. I have a lot of respect for the guy. When I sat down with him to do this piece, I said, I really don't want to go over ground that's been gone over 101 times before about individual races and teams and cars, because you know we've been there and done that over the years. So let's talk about you, the makeup of you, the person, what goes into making David Coulthard the person he is today. And as you say, the passing of his sister Lindsay, who was a young woman in her 30s, had only recently had a baby was still an infant, and she died suddenly in essentially in her sleep, and he was told this news was broken to him while he was appearing on the BBC's Saturday Kitchen, and he was doing a live appearance, and he got a note passed to him, I think by a member of the production staff, I think to say you need to make a phone call urgently to his brother, and being told this news. And I think the thing that, I mean, I, David and I knew each other. We had known each other for a long time, but we'd recently, you know, 2011, 2012, 2013, we'd been working together on a number of different things. So that was kind of current for me, and I, you know, saw some of the impact. You know, it was, he takes things very stoically, and we'll talk about the reason for that in a moment. But there's no doubt it had a huge impact on the family, as you can imagine, and the knock-on effect in terms of her, you know, her husband left without his wife and with his newborn baby. The family's response to that in Scotland, everything that they had to put in place to deal with that. And his point about Lindsay being quicker than him isn't something that he now says because she's no longer with us. He used to say that to me when we would do sessions in front of sponsors or corporate audiences. He would often say that before, you know, while she was still alive, he'd say, oh, well, of course, Lindsay, if she had been given the right opportunity, the right breaks, you know, I think she would have been even better than me. So this isn't like something he's just come up with as a kind of in memory of his sister. This is something he always maintained. And as he says in the interview, you know, when people ask him about why are you non-executive chairman of W Series, and by the way, what do we mean non-executive chairman? Essentially, Sean Wadsworth, and who is the investor behind the series, it were Sean and David who'd made W Series happen and have made its subsequent development happen by supporting Catherine, chief executive of W Series, who obviously leads their business on a day-to-day basis. But David and Sean came up with that idea. I remember them talking to me about it before it was ever announced, and they've really gotten behind it. And David's used his network to ensure that, you know, the W Series has become a support race to Formula One, that it's, you know, got good television coverage. They've struggled a little bit to get all of those sponsors in Formula One who say they're into diversity and inclusion to actually sponsor W Series. And it's interesting. That's an interesting discussion in itself about why some of the sponsors who, for relatively small money, could support that series, choose not to. So he's passionate about that. He's also recently, in fact, the week of the interview, he was going to Silverstone to announce the More Than Equal initiative, which again, he is leading as a result of partnering with an investor. And I know we have an interview with, I think it's Kate Bevan, coming up in a subsequent issue of the magazine about that. Kate Bevan being formerly of Formula One and now working on the More Than Equal initiative. So he's passionate about the fact that he wants to, you know, we talked about legacies earlier on. I think one of David's legacies wants to be to play a role in giving girls and women an opportunity to compete at the highest levels of motorsport, to have a, find a Formula One driver who's female, to encourage people irrespective of their background. I mean, he talks as well in the interview about his own family background, the fact that his godfather was from Mauritius. His godmother happened to meet his godfather while she was in the armed forces, and so he talked about the fact that when he would go and stay with them in Edinburgh, not only were they, you know, mixed race couple, but also they fostered children from troubled backgrounds. So he grew up in an environment where, you know, children came, you know, he was meeting people who came from sometimes difficult backgrounds, sometimes had learning disabilities, that kind of thing. So quite interesting to dig into some of the big influences, life influences. And then, of course, the one that he says, no question, was that was the game changer for him. And I think one of the reasons why he was perhaps able to deal with the loss of his sister in such a kind of, well, not quite stoic's probably the wrong word. I mean, he unquestionably was upset by that, but, you know, he saw it as yet another evolution of life's challenges. The big game changer for him was the plane crash in Lyon in France. And he's talked to me about that at length. I've got an interview that I did with him a few years ago, which I've never published. And it was a recorded interview. I was going to use it on a podcast, but never did.
Something rorty going past that, your window in the background there.
I was just a motorcycle going past. Yeah, one of the things that he talked, I mean, he talked in that interview in detail about what actually happened during that accident, you know, the sequence of events, the air crew trying to, you know, keep the aircraft under control. They had an engine failure, and everything was sort of kind of going fine until the last moment, and then the aircraft put a wing in as it came into land, wing went hit the ground. And the aircraft essentially cartwheeled, and it cartwheeled onto its nose, and then wiping off the nose and cockpit, both the pilots were killed. And David and his then girlfriend and his fitness trainer were left to literally walk out the front of the fuselage with a few minor cuts and bruises, and I think he had a fractured rib. And that's been life-changing for him. I think the fact that he came back and continued to race in Formula One for another 8 years was quite something, because I think he really did have a week of actually having to decide if he ever wanted to be in a plane again, if he ever wanted to fly again. Did he want to drive again? Did he want to risk his life again? And lots of things really went, really again influenced what has happened in the 22 years since. So really interesting interview to do. He was as open and candid and honest as I always find him to be. I have one criticism of David, which I've always had, is that he's far too humble about his achievements. He really sees himself as having been a good number two who could be a winner on his day. And you know, I've often said to him, you don't win 13 Grand Prix by accident, especially not back in those days when reliability wasn't what it was and safety wasn't what it was and all of that. But, you know, he unquestionably would have liked to have won the Formula One World Championship. He made a commercial decision to leave Williams and go to McLaren, and again has talked to me in the past about his decision to take the big money offer. He could have stayed at Williams and most likely won a championship, but he went to McLaren. and then discovered himself up against a Mika Hakkinen who just had a slight edge over a single lap, particularly in qualifying, and was having a professional love affair, as it were, with Ron Dennis. So Ron obviously loved Mika, and I think from the minute David agreed to move over in a race and let Mika by, that was it. You know, the die was cast, and so he was forever kind of playing slightly bridesmaid to Mika. He also talks quite often about the fact that it was his misfortune to reach the pinnacle of motorsport at the same time as Mika Hakkinen and Michael Schumacher. So he had two kind of problems on his hands every weekend. But again, that kind of puts into perspective winning two Monaco Grand Prix, winning two British Grand Prix. He's talked to me in the past about winning a French Grand Prix on a day where he remembers waking up on the Sunday morning and knowing, I'm going to win the race today. And he went out, and he didn't have a particularly brilliant start to the race, but he won it. And he's often talked about the fact that there were days where he just knew he was going to be unbeatable. And it's a little bit like a golfer who, you know, places the golf ball absolutely perfectly after a drive. You wish you could repeat that all the time, and that's what ultimately the sporting greats are able to do. And I think David's view was that he just wasn't quite able to repeat it often enough, whereas the Mikas and the Michaels and now the Lewises and the Maxes are.
When I read this interview, there was stuff that I didn't know about him and his career. So were you in that boat?
Absolutely. So I, of course, caught the tail end of his career, particularly the Red Bull days. And then his move into punditry, and he's obviously been fantastic at that as a co-anchor and in the commentary box. And that sort of there's loads of people who talked about it before, but the one I remember really sort of speaking about it and sort of I remember it most is Greg James, who, Stuart, I'm not sure if you remember, is a Radio 1 DJ. It's radio for younger listeners.
Radio 1?
Radio 1. But he talks about that when he gets approached in public, and everyone sort of assumes they go, hello, mate, instead of hello, Greg, or what are you? Because the fact that they're in their car every day or in their living room, in their kitchen, means you sort of have a tacit understanding of what they're like, who they are as a person. And I suppose I've felt like that a bit about David Coulthard. I've only ever interviewed him once or twice about non-F1 things, but in the main, growing up, it was how he came across over, you know, on the television, and if he was doing sporadic question of sport or pointless appearances or whatever it is like that. So to think you have a good picture of what he's like as a person, that he is this self-deprecating man that, you know, it always sort of plays down his own talents and talks up Mika and whatever, and then to sort of read all that, know all that, read various articles with him, and then to, as a 52-year-old man, sit down and do an interview with Mark and still coming out thinking, I didn't understand before, but I now do, about what makes him tick, what his motivations are. I took an awful lot from it, and other things sort of like speaking about his work with W Series, or you can just tell by the choice of language that this is not like some crusty ex-racing driver, just his choice of words. He's very much he's in tune with the times, and it doesn't feel like he's sort of, you know, treading around making a faux pas and ending his whole career. And there's little things like that in the Austrian GP weekend. I know he was talking about not just W Series but power steering and F2, and he sees it as the bigger picture to not only promote female drivers by W Series, but also actually take them into F1, actually have tangible results, and that he's taking a much more holistic approach, and just list little things like that, and the anecdote he gives about karting and why that's led to him being self-deprecating. I took an awful lot from it, so thank you Mark. They were a good 15 minutes well spent with a nice coffee in a searing heat today.
That's good. I'm pleased to hear it. It's really interesting what you say, and I think if you take what you've said about David and then you apply it to all of the other characters and personalities that we cover in the sport, what's the story behind? You know, what is the real story behind? And, of course, the difficulty is that a lot of drivers, team principals, they do kind of tighten up under interview situations, and they only reveal what they want to reveal, in case they don't want to show a weak side to them. What they might perceive is something that the media might then run with, and then turns into a massive headline. And, you know, I think that you know, for example, in the week we're recording this podcast, we're obviously all been reflecting on the anniversary of the passing of Jules Bianchi, and then seeing, you know, Charles Leclerc post a nice photograph of him when he was a young carter with, you know, with his cousin, godfather, you know, Jules, and talking about the impact that he had on his life. So we know a little bit of the Charles Leclerc backstory from that, you know, the Bianchi situation. But you take all the other personalities in our sport and you wonder, well, what are the influences? You know, there's the Max Verstappen story in relation to his father, Jos, how tough Jos could be on him when he was coming up through karting. You know, we talked about George Russell earlier on. Do we know the whole George Russell story? Will any, you know, will we wait 20 or 30 years to find out that there's been a particular pivotal moment in George's life, you know, or has it all been plain sailing, you know? So there are lots of things about these superstars who are, you know, the drivers in Formula One that I think are intriguing to learn about. And to do so, of course, they have to trust you as a journalist, as an interviewer. And obviously I'm fortunate in that David does trust me, and because he's known me for 30 years, so it's you know, that's very helpful. But again, going back to Nigel, you know, one of the reasons he didn't have a particularly great relationship was he didn't trust many. There weren't many media that he could trust, because somebody would go off and write some just bizarre headline, you know, to get a few more eyeballs on their print media back in the day. So getting that trust is incredibly useful, and then not abusing it, you know, not abusing it. And, you know, I said I was upfront with David right at the beginning. I said I'd like to ask you about things that you might normally have talked about, and if you feel comfortable, I, you know, promise you I'll tackle it in a sympathetic way. And you know, and he said, well, yeah, you know, far away, if there's anything I'm uncomfortable with, I'll tell you. And we, you know, we had an hour and a half's conversation. It was great. So, you know, I know he's looking forward to reading it, and he and hopefully I won't get an abusive phone call afterwards. But I'm pretty confident he'll, you know, because it was such an easy one to do, because he was so open and honest about it. So quite frankly, once I got the transcript, it kind of wrote itself.
That's good. Oh, you had a brilliant commission as well, isn't it? You get very excellent detailed commissions on this magazine.
Yes, I do, of course. I had a brilliant commission from you, Codders.
But you mentioned Jules Bianchi. One of the relatively few people who interviewed him, because, you know, he was in Formula One for a short period of time. I remember had a lovely day in Marseille with him. We went and photographed him in and around Marseille, which is where the family's from. And to be honest, I was kind of almost not looking forward to it in a way, because at the time I thought, he's one of these young drivers who's not going to have much to say for himself, and he's got his PR who's a bit fierce with him, so it could all just be a little bit horrendous. And then actually, you know, he was charm personified. He was not at all how I expected him to be. And he was like that in his press sessions at races as well, because he was driving for a back of the grid team. No one ever used to bother going to speak to him, so you could go and have a bit of a giggle with him. He was quite funny. He had a mischievous sense of humour and a real twinkle in his eye. I think he would have been brilliant on Drive to Survive, and, you know, would have matured into a very good Grand Prix driver. So he was a very, very sad loss. And what a shame that we kind of come to the end of the running time of this podcast on such a downbeat note. But unfortunately, that's the way it is. As a postscript, there is plenty more to read beyond what we've discussed today in this month's issue of GP Racing, including interviews with McLaren's team principal. If you read last month's GP Racing, you'd have seen some words by Matt Kew, but unfortunately we didn't get to discuss it because we failed to record a podcast about that issue. We also analyse the latest tech intrigue around bouncing, and we take a close-up look at Ayrton Senna's first Grand Prix winning car. So all that remains for me to do is to thank my guests. Have you got the curtains closed, Mr. Q? Because you seem to have retreated into darkness there.
I have. I was googling ways to keep the house cool early, and there's 50-50 split, so I've gone for both. One is keep windows in windows shut and blinds down, which I've got, what I've done in the office where I'm working. And then it says to get a through draft. So all the other house, I've got all the other rooms in the house, I've got windows and doors open to try and get a through draft. And both are failing. It's absolutely roasting in here. It's very unpleasant.
I think amongst the tips as to what not to do in 35 degrees is probably record a podcast for an hour and a half. But there we go. We've gone and done it. And anyway, so on an uplifting note, my room is feeling quite cool, and I'm about to go and have an early meal with my good wife. And thanks again, Codders, for having me on the podcast.
Thank you very much, Mark. Good luck packing that suitcase, and feel free to review that instructional video and smash that like button.
Yeah, will do.
Thank you to every one of you for listening to this podcast. Go to gpracing.com to check out all our subscriptions offers. And thanks also to our long-suffering producer, Martin Lee, who I hope retrieved his car safely from its MOT appointment with a full pass. We'll speak to you next month.